Oh, it is a little tape cassette.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we're doing, I'm introducing a 4-week series that we're doing here on this night, starting tonight, on what is the Sangha, which uses a lot of reading from this book, What is the Sangha, which is a really good book. I think we have a lot of books by Sangharakshita, and I think this is actually among one of the most valuable. So I'm going to start by talking about the Sangha so that we have an introduction to the notion of Sangha. And I did want to start with that, the first thing that I said, which is this, just this. That way, you know, whatever else I say, you can, if you forget and you seem to not really know what Sangha is, you can remember that it's just this. Whoop, right here. But Sangha means association or society. It's it's an ancient Indian word, and it isn't strictly Buddhist, although Buddhism as a tradition uses it in a very particular way. So we are going to be using the word in that particular way and talking about that particular meaning. So you can hear yoga groups use the word Sangha, you know, for communities of yogis. And you'll hear the word a lot in various situations, Buddhist and non-Buddhist, and probably with a lot of different notions. You know, some people use the word Sangha just to locally here, say our Sangha, which is just the people who tend to come to this place, when it could also mean a much broader thing. But I just wanted to make that clear to people that it can be used in a lot of different narrow senses and broader senses. But the sense in which I'm going to talk about it tonight is as one of the three jewels. Our community is called the Triratna Buddhist Community, which means three jewels, Buddhist community. So jewels are very precious, and that is the connotation, that these are very, very precious. Sangharakshita says in this book, he kind of begins it by pointing out, or at least he begins one particular chapter by pointing out that religious traditions always have concepts, images, ideals, kind of, that they put at the core of whatever it is that they're teaching. And in Buddhism, it's these three jewels. They're the it's not a god or a deity. It's the three jewels. It's like the three jewels are the ideals that represent together, not separate. Now, they're not separate things. They together, they actually represent the ideal that is, in a sense, beyond words, that's actually an experience, which is not different than what I was saying, which is this. So the three jewels are the Buddha, as I started the evening with when we saluted the shrine, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. For quite literal reasons, in a certain sense, the Buddha comes first, because as an image and as a mythic story, and quite literally, the Buddha realized awakening for himself. He realized ease where there was stress and joy where there was sorrow. And he realized that to perfection. And He realized it in a sense with the help of others, but also he realized it in a way that was totally unique, not taught to him by others, so to speak. So that's the mythic story, is that even though he had help from people who gave him practices and various kinds of teachings that helped him kind of figure it out, he actually realized a state of ease and a state of joy that none of his teachers had really realized. So he came first in that sense. That is the traditional story. So it's the Buddha. The Buddha realized the heart that does wish all beings joy. And so he's the first. And it's important to see that the Buddha is an ideal. So the Buddha is the ideal that all of us have this potential to have this realization, to realize in a very pure way the desire for all beings to be happy, to realize it in a way that is totally clear and without confusion. The perfection of energy, wisdom, compassion, various things like that.
I think I'll do a couple cards.
After this realization, he taught it. So just as he had had teachers teach him things that he realized, once he had realized this kind of perfect ease and ability to understand the world, he decided to teach it, and he taught it to some of his former comrades or friends. And in his teaching of it arose the Dharma. So that was the next thing that came. So there was the Buddha, and then there's this Dharma. And this Dharma is, it is like a body of teaching, but it's not abstract because it was only discovered through the Buddha's desire to communicate. So he didn't have the Dharma until he started thinking, how do I get people to understand this? How do I get my friends to realize ease where there is stress and joy, where there is sorrow? And in his communication arose the Dharma. So in his quest to communicate to his friends, there became the Dharma. And the Dharma kept growing as his friends then communicated with their friends, and so on and so on and so on, until now. And there's a whole lot of Dharma since then. So we've got 2,500 years of Dharma in a certain sense of communication of this way to ease and way to transform sorrow into joy. So that's the Dharma. And it's said... So it was interesting that even in the Buddha's day, there was so much going on in terms of this communication that the Buddha's own mother had to ask him, well, so all these people are teaching all these different ways. How do we know like what it is that your Dharma is? Because Dharma is also known in a particular, very kind of narrow sense. It's also understood in Indian language to be like a particular method, or a particular school or teaching. And so they want to know, what is your method in your teaching if all your followers are doing all these different things? And so the Buddha said, those teachings which when put into practice, this is important, those teachings which when put into practice, which when practiced, not just thought about, lead to such things as detachment, decrease of worldly accumulation, frugality, contentment, patience, energy, and delight in the good. Those teachings can be known as my Dharma. So, rather than narrowly define what his teaching was, he pointed to the outcomes so that anybody who had heard who heard those words would have to go find out for themselves what leads to these qualities. And it's known as being like a raft. So there's a raft simile where the teachings are utilized to realize the ease, right? To realize the joy. And nothing else. They're not just ends in of themselves. So whatever practices are being taught, they lead to the goal. And that's their only purpose, really. They're also of the nature of a personal invitation. This is one of my favorite lines, that the Buddhist teachings, for them to be the Buddhist teachings, they have to be sort of the quality or of the nature of a personal invitation. So somebody says you should meditate. Does that feel like a personal invitation? I don't know. Or, you know, you should be nice to people. Does that feel like a personal invitation? So whatever it is of the nature of a personal invitation. It's not just a personal invitation. It has that nature. Its very nature is of a personal invitation. And that's what makes it the Dharma. So that's the second jewel. And I think it's important to talk about, and actually Sangharakshita does the same thing in the beginning of this book, that if we're going to talk about Sangha, we have to actually talk about them within the context of those two jewels, because it's not a separate thing. To understand what Sangha means, you have to understand what these other two jewels are. So now we come to Sangha, which is the subject of our series. And as I've said, it could be society or association. But in Buddhism, it is that group of people who recognize something in the Buddha's teaching worthy of pursuing to such a degree as to explicitly associate with each other on that basis, to learn from each other on that basis, on the basis of the search for ease and on the basis of the search for joy and the search for the recognition of the desire for kindness within us and without. So this community is a network of friendships. Many of you may have heard this. There was a time when the Buddha's companion, Ananda, who was supposed to have spent gads of time with the Buddha, said to the Buddha, "It seems to me," and I'm not quoting, I'm just going by memory, "but it seems to me that this whole thing is largely about friendship." And the Buddha responded with something like, "Oh no, don't say that. It's all about friendship." And of course, it wasn't quite like that. But the whole of the spiritual life, somehow the Buddha was indicating, is about friendship. So that it isn't just that our friendships as a spiritual community is a means towards a goal. It is also the goal. And that's why it's one of these jewels. So one of the practices that I have picked up in my explicit membership in the spiritual community is making an effort to recognize, even in people who aren't Buddhists, but particularly amongst the community of Buddhists, The impetus within people to desire beauty, to desire kindness, not just for themselves, but for others, to want to be clear about things, essentially looking for the qualities, the flavor of the Buddha's awakening in everybody. So I think that the spiritual community, in the explicit sense, as in people who gather as Buddhists, are doing this as a practice. And in doing this, both inwardly and outwardly, so we're trying to recognize the qualities of awakening in ourselves and the qualities of awakening in others, because, and I won't get into the mechanics of this, but basically because they grow in the sunlight of awareness. So when we recognize whatever shred of good quality we can see in ourselves and others, it sort of grows. It sort of becomes more apparent, but also in that apparentness, sort of, because of its apparent nature, it has even more apparent nature. And that's the odd thing about awareness. It's just like that with anything in our body. If we feel a little pain and we become incredibly aware of it, it's much more apparent to us. If same with pleasure, same with most things we're aware of, they become more influential. And I would submit that in a certain sense, the very qualities that the Buddha realized are innate in all of us at any given moment. And that with awareness, they become functional. Yeah, so as a community, because more people can be more aware, this is more possible. So there's this term, going for refuge, which I thought I would talk a little bit about. Sangharakshita talks about it in this book. Going for refuge is an act of recognizing the potential for a kind of beauty, the beauty that the three jewels represents. So the way we can recognize the beauty of the three jewels could happen in a number of ways. And I think, broadly speaking, you could say that it's sort of cognitive and rational and emotional and inspirational, right? So they're both really important. We have to sort of, we can think about the three jewels and think, oh, that's really great. We can think about how being aware of something affects us and sort of makes us more able to operate with relationship to the thing more effectively in any given way, whatever. This is kind of rational thinking. But we can also have a kind of general inspiration. There's some part of us can resonate with the beauty of a thing without having to rationally figure that out. And I was having the thought in relationship to some of the things Sangharakshita was writing that going for refuge is both those things. It's recognizing real beauty and both analyzing it, so to speak, but also opening our hearts up to it in relationship to our thoughts about it. Because our thoughts about it aren't just practical, so to speak. Because beauty isn't just practical, if that makes sense. Because going for refuge isn't just about practical. It's about the highest beauty, and the highest beauty perhaps we haven't actually seen yet. I'm not sure what else to say about that, but it wouldn't contradict your rationale but or your analysis. But it would, but the analysis would serve your kind of heart's deepest wish. So going for refuge is allowing yourself to serve your heart's deepest wish, and giving your heart's deepest wish an actual direction, with the understanding that you will continue to question that. So fully opening your heart up to a direction with all the faculties available to you to continue to hone that direction. Those faculties being both of the heart and of the mind, so to speak. The Sangha is something we can go to refuge to. And if you're going for refuge to the Sangha, traditionally speaking, you're going for refuge to those who have realized the Buddha's awakening, so realized the perfection of kindness in their own heart. And I think this is a good way to think about it, because over thousands of years, this has happened. People have perfected their heart, have opened their hearts up to the great love. And so that's what we go for refuge to, in one sense. But we also go for refuge to that potential in all of us together. So we're going for refuge to all the future Buddhas as well. Just as much as all the past Buddhas. And these are all the future Buddhas here tonight. That is part of what we're doing when we go for refuge to the Sangha. Yeah, so we're going to hear from Megan about her going for refuge to the Sangha.